Studies at Marine Corps University presents The Intellectual Challenge of Totalitarian Islamism by Dr. Doug Strussen, Marine Corps University. Dr. Doug Strussen is a professor of international relations at the Command and Staff College, Marine Corps University, Quantico, Virginia, an adjunct professor at the Institute of World Politics. An Islamic historian by training, he has written and taught on a wide variety of historical and national security-related topics. His major publications include The Formation of the Mughal Empire and articles entitled Choosing Words Carefully, Vocabulary to Fight Islamic Terrorism in the Military Intelligence Professional Bulletin, Managing the Iranian Threat to Sea Commerce Diplomatically in Getting Ready for a Nuclear Ready Iran, Sir Hamilton Gibb, Abu Yusuf and the Concept of Islamic Civilization in the History and Historiography of Post-Mughal Central Asia, Studies in Honor of Professor John E. Woods, Geopolitics versus Globalization in Globalization and Maritime Power, European Islam or Islamic Europe, and What Does Jihad Mean? A second book, The Islamic Gunpowder Empires in World History, released by Westview Press in 2010. Dr. Strussen received his PhD from the University of Chicago. This lecture took place Tuesday, 8 April, 2014, the Gray Research Center, Quantico, Virginia.
Introduce to you one of our own colleagues. We have been doing the lecture series since I have been here now, 8 years, and we have tried to open up this forum for as part of a dialogue between our students, faculty, and what I would call the MCU family, which you all are, if you're here, you like to hear what we have to say. And we have looked at all aspects of that area that we call the Middle East. It is a forum for doing what we do in the classroom, which is we have some of the best teachers, you'll hear one of them right now, but also to bring it out and have a dialogue outside of the classroom, exchange with different people that you're used to sitting with, and that's the, one of the basis of it. And secondly, to actually showcase some of the jewels that we have. We have great faculty, but if we don't have an exchange, what happens is that, again, that jewel stays in that one classroom rather than coming out. So I personally, as the director of Middle East Studies, I'm very, very pleased, honored, and thankful for Dr. Strussen to not only agree to come here, but also have been in most of our sessions throwing questions and being there. Some of you know Dr. Strussen very well. He is a professor of international relations at the Command and Staff College, Marine Corps University, right across there, and soon to go into this wonderful new building that's being built, and an adjunct professor at the Institute of World Politics. An Islamic historian by training, he has written and taught on a wide variety of historical and national security-related topics. His major publications include The Formation of the Mughal Empire, that was published by Oxford University Press in 1989, and a recent one, Islamic Gunpowder Empires in the World History, released in 2010. We were just discussing right now, we are maybe, some of you know Bartold, those of you who are old Middle East hands, we consider ourselves grandchildren of Bartold, so at least cousins of, we are all trained by people who were trained by Bartold. So it's wonderful to see a much more senior, more smarter of the Middle East hands that I grew up listening to. Without further ado, and one more announcement. May the 5th at 10:00, we have a panel on Turkey. If you're interested in Turkey, we have three people. This is in conjunction with Marine Corps War College, but it's open again to everyone. 10:00, if you are not part of our mailing list, please talk to Adam Seitz there. It is going to have three panelists that I think you will find very interesting, talking about Turkey from a U.S. Turkey, Turkey internal, and then Turkey regional. Please, well, thank you again for joining us.
Thank you, Amin, and thank you, General Wiley, not only in your own person, but as a representative of all of the predecessors of as MCU presidents, going back to Donald Gardner, who have made this truly a university. as you will eventually see in my after-action report, I attended the Society for Military History meeting over the weekend, and there was a panel there composed of Army War College faculty talking about all of the things that they're trying to do there to make the Army War College a serious graduate school, all of which we have been doing all along, including other things, encouraging professors to go to conferences and allowing them to do it as TAD, because at the Army War College, they've always had to take leave to do it until very recently. So thank you, sir, and thank all those who came along. Thank you to Dr. Jerry Wilson, the Vice President for Academic Affairs, who has mentored and encouraged me since I got here in 2005, and we did eventually get over the trauma of hearing him use the word latrine in our early conversations. And I also would like to thank the leadership of the Command and Staff College, especially the Dean, Dr. Duncan Kent, for his support. The talk that I'm going to go through today is really, in some ways, a product of studying Islamic politics since 1976. So when Dr. Tarzi said that he was one of the more senior members, he wasn't kidding. Falls into three parts. One is talking about what I mean by totalitarian Islamism. Significance or what totalitarian Islamism is, and three, why it has been so difficult for the West and the United States in general to come to grips with this phenomenon intellectually, which in turn has made it difficult to come to grips with it in a policy manner. So that's why my title is the intellectual challenge of totalitarian Islamism, not simply the challenge of Islamism. It's an intellectual challenge because nearly 13 years after the 9/11 attacks and more than 30 years after the Iranian Revolution, there is still no consensus about the nature of the threat. There is still severe disagreement. And this lack of clarity on the nature of the threat makes it, in turn, difficult to do what we know what to do about it. And the absence of a consensus on the threat is very clear. There are three different schools. One is that there is no ideology behind terrorism, that it's simply a response to grievances about against Western policies and actions, past and present. When I spoke at Rutgers University last week before the SMH conference, one of the faculty members there said that he had just heard a speech a couple of weeks earlier by one of the most eminent figures in the field of international relations, saying that there is no ideology involved. The dichotomy of grievances versus ideology is false anyway, because the ideology focuses and intensifies the grievances, and the grievances nourish the ideology, but an ideology that certainly is. The second broadly accepted view, and the one that both the Bush and Obama administrations have accepted, is that the danger is an ideology that they define vaguely as violent extremism. And what they mean by violent extremism is what many people would call radical Islam, but they, for good reasons, do not want to say Islam. My views are closest to that school that differ significantly. And then the third view is that the enemy is Islam itself. And the reason that those views are able to continue is that there basically, there is no traditional intellectual discourse, no academic, single academic program that covers all of the different things that one needs to know to understand this phenomenon. And the second piece, why totalitarian Islamism, not Islamism, is because it is the totalitarianism that makes totalitarian Islamism the kind of threat that it is. And so when I want to use a shorthand for totalitarian Islamists, I say totalitarians, because a totalitarian, no matter what the basis of the totalitarianism is, whether it's Marxism-Leninism or Gulf, is irretrievably evil. And I would argue that the failure to identify the ideology of the enemy or enemies as totalitarian, as a totalitarian ideology, has hindered our response to it. So to start out, of course, with the definitions of totalitarianism and Islamism. And totalitarianism is essentially any philosophy that promises the obtaining paradise on earth. Any philosophy that contends that paradise on earth is obtainable through human action. Newtonian philosophy follows a perfect society through human effort, whether it's secular utopia or the kingdom of God on earth. And the promise of perfection justifies and requires the use of any possible means to obtain it. So the utopian end requires the totalitarian means. The promise of perfection is the other side of totalitarianism, and if the result is that any ideology that promises utopia becomes the dystopia in power, as we have seen with Nazi Germany, with the various Marxist-Leninist regimes, and with the follow-on. So there is a difference between these utopian ideologies and the belief in the eventual redemption of mankind through the return of a Messiah. Because those eschatologies make the obtaining of paradise on earth dependent on the will of God. Whereas utopian ideologies, whether they are secular or religious, make paradise on earth available through human action. Although I'm not going to go into it in this talk, the political philosopher Eric Bowman, who unfortunately delighted in making his work as obscure as possible to the extent that never using an existing work he could possibly get away with making up a new one, this is one whose work clarifies the nature of totalitarianism best, to the extent that anyone writing in such an obscure matter can clarify anything. But the relationship of utopian, secular utopian ideologies and religions is a familiar point. Back in 1974, I guess, within a few months of each other, encountered the same point in Robert C. Tucker's Philosophy and Mythic, Karl Marx and Raymond Aron's The Century of Total War, both of them describe Marxism as a Christian heresy. So that's totalitarianism. The definition of Islamism is a matter of controversy. And one definition, which is sort of explains the use of the word, is Islam transformed into a political ideology. The other definition is simply the belief in the involvement of Islam in politics as a constitutive principle. That is, Islamism as the opposite of secularism. For most of the people who use the term, this difference is a difference that makes no difference. Because they accept the proposition that Islamic law constitutes a complete prescription for human behavior. So that if one allows Islam as a constitutive principle at all, it implies accepting it as the only constitutive principle. So, in other words, any state that is Islamist at all would have to be a theocracy under this view, so that the alternative to theocracy is the complete exclusion of Islamic politics, that is to say, secularism. Theocracy, by the way, is not necessarily totalitarian or utopian, because there can be theocratic governments that govern in this life in order to ensure individual salvation in the next. And there can be theocracy of governments intended to establish paradise on earth. The problem with the argument that the only alternative to theocracy is secularism is that it runs aground on history. Although some Muslims contend that Islamic law is a complete prescription for every aspect of life, it never has been. Islamic law has never been the basis of Muslim governments in any practical sense, even if they have administered. Nor has it been the only source, or in many cases even the primary source, of political legitimacy in Muslim polities, or the criterion for determining succession to high office, or primary guide for state rank. In fact, contrary to what the common impression, historical Islamic states have always had mixed legal systems in which Islamic law, the Sharia, operated exclusively only in the areas of commercial law and family law for Muslims. It has never really provided a basis of tax systems, for example, or other forms of it, of administration, and nor has it normally operated in the realm of criminal law. Because although we're all familiar with some of the more extreme penalties that Islamic law applies in certain cases, it also has extremely restrictive rules of evidence. The most sensational case being that a prosecution for adultery is acceptable only if the adultery takes place in the presence of four witnesses. And most people committing adultery keep the number of witnesses below that number. In the case of the Ottoman Empire, for example, about which we know a good deal about the criminal administration, the such a penalty like cutting off the hand of a thief is only be implemented only in the case of a sort of career criminal, lifelong offender, so similar to a sort of three strikes and you're out rule in U.S. justice. So the involvement of Islam in politics historically has not implied theocracy. And for that reason, I use the term to imply the belief in the involvement of Islam in politics, the idea of Islam as a constitutive principle, but not necessarily the constitutive principle. So I distinguish among three types of Islamism. One is what I call historical or normal Islamism, which is the sort of situation that I just described, in which Islam is a source of political legitimacy and a source of governmental law, but not the only source of legitimacy or the only source of law. The second is extreme Islamism, which one might also call Shari, Shari being the adjective for Sharia, authoritarianism. When the situation in which Islamic law is the sole basis of political legitimacy and of the legal system. But extreme Islamism in this form is really only a hypothetical construct because there is not enough content in the Sharia addressing political issues for it to become the basis of a constitution of the state. And if you examine those states that claim to base their regimes on Islamic law, Saudi Arabia and Iran, you find that, in fact, that the actual governmental institutions are not products of the provisions of the Sharia. The third variety is totalitarian Islamism, the interpretation of Islam as a utopian ideology which justifies and requires a totalitarian regime. And totalitarian Islamism is a fusion of the ideological basis of extreme Islamism with Western 20th century totalitarian ideas. So totalitarian Islamism is not solely the product of the internal intellectual dynamics of Islamic civilization. It is a product of the contact between Islam and the West. And that in itself is one of its vulnerabilities, because the adherents of totalitarian Islamism claim to be presenting the correct interpretation of Islam, but one cannot get from Muhammad to Osama bin Laden without a stop off to at the Finland station to talk to Vladimir Ilyich Lenin. Another way of putting totalitarian Islamism in context is to look at the overall political attitudes that Muslims have had for years. Let's talk about attitudes or temperaments, not philosophies. General approaches to politics and the way that Islam requires Muslims to behave in a political sense. And there have been essentially three temperaments, three attitudes. The first one is quietism. And the quietist position holds that in the absence of a divinely inspired leader, that is, in the case of the Sunnis, Muhammad himself or his four successors, the so-called rightly guided caliphs, the Rashidun, or the Shi'is, the Ali or Muhammad or Ali or one of the later Imams, that politics and government are inherently corrupt and corrupting, and that pious Muslims should obey government in order to avoid the evil of anarchy. There's the old Arabic proverb that a day of anarchy is worse than 100 years of tyranny. Although one can argue with the mathematics of that observation, I think it is irrefutable that one can have order without justice, but not justice without order. But Quietists hold essentially, most of all, that a pious Muslim should not take a position that involves receiving a government salary, because the government salary is almost always based on illegal or unjust taxes, so anyone who takes one is participating in money laundering. So basically, the Quietist position holds that because no government can really meet the standards of Islam, that pious Muslims should avoid involvement in politics at all. The opposite position is that of activism, which holds that Islam requires political action in order to establish a truly Islamic polity and society. And the key characteristic of activism is that it has always been an ideology of opposition. Activism has challenged the status quo in the Islamic world in the name of Islam. Activism appeared within a few decades of Muhammad's death as a form of resistance to the transformation of the Muslim polity into a bureaucratic empire, which was a necessary product of the conquest in which the Muslim polity incorporated Egypt and Syria from the Eastern Roman Empire and Iraq and then the Iranian plateau from the Sasanian Empire. So activism really developed in opposition to the transformation of the Muslim polity into a bureaucratic empire, and that bureaucratization occurred really before the transformation of the rulers of the Muslim community into monarchs. So the assassins of the third caliph Uthman in 656 who essentially opposed the attempt to transform them from tribal warriors fighting on their own account to soldiers paid by a government a fixed salary and turning their booty over to the government. And then the assassins of Thorkel Ali in 661 killed him because he was willing to compromise with the forces of the bureaucracy. So those were the assassins of Uthman and Ali in the 7th century were the original activists. So you can see that the activist tradition, as I said, is a tradition of dissent, a tradition of opposition. And the activists were the losers in the first two periods of civil war in the Muslim community, the so-called first and second fitnas, one from 656 to 661, the other from 683 to 692. Activism in power would resemble what I call extreme Islamism or Sharia authoritarianism. But in practice, when activist groups have gained power, their polities have rather swiftly come to resemble the governments that they overthrew. In other words, revolution has not worked any better in the Islamic world than it has anywhere else. It breaks eggs, but never makes omelets. And you talk about why the American Revolution is different if you care to. One of the most important figures in the activist tradition was Ibn Taymiyyah, who wrote in Egypt in the late 13th and early 14th centuries. And Ibn Taymiyyah developed a vital doctrine for the activists and for the totalitarians today, known as takfir. Some of you are familiar with the word kafir, referring to infidel. But the doctrine of takfir holds that one Muslim can identify another Muslim, another professing Muslim, as a non-Muslim on the basis of that second Muslim's refusal to act in the way that that first Muslim believes that a Muslim should. It's a very awkward description of what one word means. The term the kafir means to designate someone as a kafir. And this doctrine runs counter to mainstream Islamic thought. Because Islam, as you know, means submission to God. And with it comes another term, Iman meaning faith. So Muslims are not only Muslims, submitters, but mu'mins, believers. And the mainstream Islam believes that only God can judge the validity of a person's submission to faith. Since the relationship is obviously between that individual and God, only God can judge. So the doctrine of takfir, in the view of mainstream Muslims, is putting humans in the place of God, which religions generally disapprove of. It's also an extremely divisive doctrine from a social and political point of view, because if you give one person the power to designate another as a non-Muslim and therefore to claim that that person is in fact an apostate and he has the right to kill him, is not conducive to social order. Both quietism and activism are forms of dissent, forms of opposition. But historians have not really looked at what they were opposing in the same way. There's a good bit of discussion of quietism and activism in Daniel Pipes's In the Path of God, for example. But the third temperament has not received nearly as much attention. And the third temperament is, in fact, the mainstream. The normal approach that most Muslims apparently took, not really upholding it. And that position, the mainstream, in fact, accepted the legitimacy of political forms and institutions and practices that were not of Muslim origin, that is, they were not responses to the Islamic revelation, and in fact came from the pre-existing governing traditions in the Middle East. And it's quite inevitable that Islamic civilization would include those traditions, because there was more than 3,000 years of urban literate civilization in the Middle East before Islam appeared. Islam did not wipe away that history. It, in fact, produced a synthesis, which is what we call Islamic civilization, between the existing civilization, existing political forms, and Islam. And the mainstream accepted this synthesis as legitimate, as proper. They did not perceive a conflict between Islam and political ideas that came from outside. In fact, in many cases, they regarded Islam and those governmental institutions as interdependent. This means that the mainstream, in fact, accepted the rulers of the Muslim community, the caliphs, as, for all practical purposes, sacred kings, as possessors of a divine mandate to rule, and just the same kind of mandate that their Roman and Sasanian successors had claimed. And that's they transfer that acceptance from the caliphal dynasties to other dynasties. They recognize with that idea of sacred kingship a form of a theory of social order known as the circle of justice. And the first elements, the earliest elements we have in writing about this, go back to the appear in the Code of Hammurabi. And it's also described as the basis of the Afghan government's development plan in 2007. So I think we can call it durable. And very briefly, the circle of justice holds that society has a model with four main pieces, which are essentially the four cardinal points of the circle. At the top, you have the king. The king's role is to ensure justice for the general population. in general peasants. And justice in this context means, most of all, protection from his own officials, from unjust and unpredictable and extreme taxation, most of all, and other forms of official oppression. In return for getting justice to the king, from the king, the peasants pay their taxes in the treasury. The treasury, in turn, pays the salaries of the army, which in turn ensures the power of the king. And if this society, this model of society, functions as it ought to, and the king is thus fulfilling the terms of his divine mandate to rule, the belief is that will in turn make the natural world work right, and that it will get rain at the right time, and sun at the right time, and no locusts, and things like that. The objection to locusts developed before the issue of their internal flight operations. So you see that this mainstream sees no contradiction between Islamic law and monarchy and bureaucracy, and accepts dynastic conceptions of legitimacy, which really came from outside of Islam completely. So talking about the mainstream in historical terms, in contemporary terms, the mainstream implied position implies the acceptance of, again, political structures, forms, practices that are not products of the Islamic revelation. Just as the way that the world was governed and organized in the 7th century was sacral kingship and bureaucratic empires, today, at least in form, the dominant form of organization is liberal democracy. And there is, in theory at least, no reason why the mainstream should be any less capable of reconciling with the idea of liberal democracy than it was with sacred kingship and the circle of justice. And one of the reasons for arguing that the mainstream is the mainstream is simply this: that governance, in accord with the principle that I described, existed throughout the history of Islamic civilization, with a general acceptance of their legitimacy. So it seems contrary to human nature for people to live under governments that they regard as illegitimate for 1,000 years. Even if they will find ways to consider them legitimate, or they'll find ways to change the government, one or the other. There is also substantial textual evidence. And just one figure that I will mention, one text, is a man named Abu Yusuf. Abu Yusuf was a pivotal figure, a formative figure in the development of Islamic law, in that he was the chief judge of the Caliph Harun al-Rashid, who you may know as the Caliph of the 1001 Nights. And as such, he was the first person to have the office of chief judge in one of the Muslim empires. He was also one of the formative figures in the development of what's known as the Hanafi school of law, the Hanafi madhab in Arabic, which is the school of law that the most Muslims adhere to today. And Abu Yusuf wrote the first text in the Muslim tradition dealing with political thought, although since it's the introduction to a tax manual, it hasn't received as much attention as it might. The book is called the Kitab al-Haraj, which is an accurate title, the Book of Land Tax. But in this text, Abu Yusuf, who was, again, a formative figure in Islamic thought, embraces the idea of sacred kingship because he asserts that the authority of the ruler comes to the ruler directly from God, and that the ruler is responsible only to God. He uses the image of the ruler as shepherd, and the shepherd in general, the ruler is not the owner of the flock himself, he or she, the shepherdess, is the agent of the owner. Similarly, the ruler as the shepherd is responsible not to the flock itself, but to the owner of the flock, God. So that's, you know, sacred kingship and the divine mandate to rule. And the vocabulary which Abu Yusuf uses in this text is very much reminiscent of the circle of justice, and in fact is very much reminiscent of a very different tradition in the literature of the Islamic world, the so-called mirror princes tradition, or books of advice for kings, which are taken by most historians as almost in opposition to Islamic law, as if they assume that the idea of monarchy is really hostile to Islam and Islamic law. Yet you have Abu Yusuf, who is one of the architects of Islamic law, embracing it. Again, not to belabor this too much, there are a number of other authors that I could cite. I can also mention, just as one example, the wide variety of titles that the Ottoman Empire, the Islamic State, with which the West had the most contact, used over the years. They used the title Sultan, which is an Arabic word which implies universal sovereignty, unlimited sovereignty and government in accord with the principles of Islam. They used the term Padishah, which is an Iranian term for universal emperor. They used the term Khan, which is a Turco-Mongol term for a ruler or a commander. They used a Persian word called Sholohendiga, which is another word for universal empire. And after the conquest of Constantinople, they also called themselves Caesar of Rome, Caesar of Rome, which I think you will look, you can all agree, is really not a concept of Islamic origin. And so the wide variety of the different concept of legitimacy to which the Ottoman titles refer is just an indication that their conceptions of legitimacy were not restricted to Islam or Islamic law. So totalitarian Islamism is the contemporary form of activism. And as I said, it is a product of the interaction of the tradition of activism with Western totalitarian ideas. Concretely, as most of you probably know, there are three main totalitarian Islamist thinkers. The Egyptian Sayyid Qutb, who was executed in 1965. The Pakistani Abu Ala Maududi, who died in Buffalo, New York, where his son was a physician in 1979. And the Ayatollah Khomeini. Maududi, who actually started writing earlier than either of the others, read Lenin's What Is to Be Done, and had, I believe, significant interaction with the Indian Communist Party back in the 30s. And from What Is to Be Done, he borrowed Lenin's distinctive notion of the vanguard party that would create a revolutionary situation. As if you recall, you know, Marx believed that a socialist revolution could occur only when capitalism reached its most extreme form. And Lenin was trying to bring about a communist revolution in the least industrialized country of Europe, Russia. So he didn't want to wait for capitalism. He wanted to accelerate the process, and the Vanguard Party was the mechanism that he developed to bring that about. And Maududi argued that the establishment of Islamic regimes should rely on the vanguard party. That's an indication of the Western influence. Sayyid Qutb probably read Lenin. Khomeini certainly did, well, certainly didn't, but both of them read Maghribi. The totalitarians embrace takfir, which takes them out of the mainstream. And they also, quite clearly, believe that political action in accord with their principles will bring about paradise on earth. One of them writes, for example, that jihad, as they define it, will bring about the kingdom of God on earth. It's a pretty clear statement that they believe in the availability of utopia on earth through human action. Like other totalitarian ideologies, the totalitarian Islamists believe that they or their successors will inevitably triumph in the future, but that there is an absolute moral imperative for them to participate in the struggle. So that if they are not there to gain the future victory, they will end up in paradise because of their efforts. There was also some influence from fascism on totalitarian Islamism. Among other things, one of Khomeini's biographers claims that he developed his view of Jews from listening to Nazi propaganda broadcast in Arabic. But influence is primarily Marxist-Leninist. In describing totalitarian Islamism as totalitarian, I am deliberately challenging the various observers who define Islam itself as totalitarian. And again, that perspective is simply historically false. For one thing, those interpreters argue that Islam requires a combination of governmental and religious leadership. That's what they, how they define the caliphate. Well, in the first place, for most of Islamic history, there has not been a functional caliphate. And even when there was one, that in fact the caliph was not a religious leader in the sense of someone who determined religious doctrine. In fact, when the caliphs attempted to impose a specific theology, they were unable to do so. So, having explained totalitarian Islamism, I have in a while to talk about why we've had such difficulty dealing with it. Field Marshal William Slim, in one of his many pearls of wisdom, said that whatever differences the battles that the British Army had fought had, they were universally fought uphill and at the junction of two World War map sheets. And what has happened, in a sense, this challenge has appeared at the junction of two or more intellectual traditions, and none of them has had all of the tools necessary to understand it. In general, very few people who understood the political history of Islam or Islamic politics understood totalitarian philosophies. And very few people who understand enough about Islam to distinguish Islam itself from totalitarianism. And many of the people with expertise on the Middle East, on Islamic civilization, were, in general, disengaged from the realities of politics and national security. So I'm going to talk about three general traditions of intellectual discourse. One is Middle East studies, one is national security studies, and one is like political conservatism. Middle East studies, the study of the Middle East as a region, is where real expertise is, where my analysis of texts and Ottoman titles and political history comes from. But unfortunately, like most of the social science and humanities components of American academia, and even Western academia, Middle East studies is detached from problems of national security. And many people in it adhere naturally to the grievances view of what I call the totalitarian Islamist threat because of their adherence to general anti-Western and anti-capitalist positions. On the other hand, the people in Middle East studies are the people with the language skills, with the historical knowledge, with the understanding of the history necessary to understand contemporary phenomena. And yet, unfortunately, the official organization, the scholarly organization that deals with Middle East studies, the Middle East Studies Association, actually in 2009 passed a resolution that its members should not cooperate with the Department of Defense. People on the national security studies side were, for one thing, until the 9/11, focused on state threats, not familiar with other civilizations or particularly with issues in political philosophy, and had, in general, because of their focus on anti-communism, generally tended to regard Islam as a good thing because it was a barrier against the growth of communism. So they were slow to adapt to the threat and slow to argue about it. After all, for example, I believe that almost 10 years after the end of the Cold War, still there are more people at the Defense Language Institute who are studying Russian than any other language. The conservative tradition regarded itself as the guardian of Western civilization and was extremely suspicious of the study of other civilizations in general. Regarded that study as tantamount to multiculturalism, to devaluing the West and treating all civilizations as equivalent. And they tended to draw their views on Islam from the Western intellectual tradition. And the Western intellectual tradition is one of the wonders of the world, but not every writer in that tradition is correct. I don't think that any of us today would take Aristotle's genetics, for example, seriously. Aristotle believed plausibly, I suppose, but quite inaccurately, that all the ostrich was the result of the mating of camels and sparrows. So that without disrespecting Aristotle's ethics and politics, we have no problem discarding his genetics or his physics. And similarly, we can have great regard for the wisdom of Edward Gibbon without accepting his views of Islam. Both national security studies and conservatism fall into the error of regarding Islamic civilization entirely as a product of Islam, not understanding the composite nature of Islamic civilization, and giving priority to religious explanations for activity in the Islamic world. So this assumption that if whatever Muslims are doing, Islam is behind it, has hindered detailed investigation of interpretations of Islam. And the conservatives, for all of their wisdom, went into very, very, very obvious errors. All of you probably in this room have read some part of Herodotus' histories of war between the Greeks and the Persians. Herodotus depicts that war as a continuation of a struggle between East and West that goes back to the Trojan War and even beyond it, really almost at the beginning of human history. And many conservative writers are happy to put the struggle against totalitarian Islamism into that context of the struggle between East and West, without recognizing that totalitarian Islamism is a revolutionary tradition which is would be opposed to the monarchy of Darius and Xerxes as it is to Western society today. So this is a complex topic, certainly different from the contemporary topics that the speakers did, from the admirable and enlightening series of speakers that Dr. Tarzi and Mr. Seitz have been able to conjure up for us. But I hope that I have conveyed to you the importance of understanding the history of Islamic civilization and the nature of the threat, and to give you very briefly. If we were to define the threat as totalitarianism, if we were to say that our fathers fought communism, our grandfathers, or I should say our parents fought communism, our grandparents fought fascism, this is the same animal with a different coat, it would make very clear that we were not opposing Islam. And the totalitarian Islamists try desperately to depict the struggle as one between Islam and its enemies, with themselves as the representatives of Islam. And that perception, the success in maintaining that perception, is one of the reasons that they have continued to be able to recruit. So if we can counter that perception by emphasizing the totalitarian nature, by putting Bin Laden in a rogue's gallery next to Heinrich Himmler and Felix Dzerzhinsky, we can, I think, get out of the framework of Islam versus the West. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I think Dr. Stusen has. First of all, thank you. We do contemporary, but I think in order for us to challenge your title and think about these things, I think we need this kind of discussions, and we are a graduate university, so I'm glad and I'm very thankful that you opened this. I have questions, but I'll keep it because first we open it to the floor. Other than asking about how an ostrich and a sparrow can get together, any questions you have?
Please. I assure you, I know nothing more than you can.
Please identify yourself if you could and ask a question.
Ida Wong, I'm from Operations Analysis Division. But thank you very much for the talk. Very, very interesting. But one question I had was, oftentimes you have in the U.S. government bureaucracy this term called modern Islam. Even Secretary Gates, through the NIRBA initiative, they funded research on how to bolster modern Islamic networks. So how useful or accurate is this concept that the U.S. government has of modern Islam?
Well, I would answer that question, first of all, by asking those of you in uniform in the audience, how you would like being called a moderate Marine. And the term moderate implies, in the eyes of many, a lack of commitment, a lack of, that one is only sort of moderately committed to Islam. And that the term, and for that, I do not use the term for that reason, is I have had people say, don't call me a moderate Muslim, I am a Muslim. I am, in fact, a better Muslim, a more committed Muslim than those than the mass murderers are. So I think that the use of the term moderate is counterproductive. And that's why, again, I use the term mainstream. This also indicates that the totalitarian Islamists are outside the norm. In terms of fostering moderate, so-called, or mainstream networks, the problem with it is that we do not want to put an American stamp on them, because in the eyes of many Muslims, that taints their authenticity. And in some ways, the best way for us to foster the development of mainstream networks is to is benign neglect. While our conduct of the informational aspect, of the ideological war, the war of ideas, is extremely important, if we have a limited standing within it. Some of my colleagues have said, well, you know, President Bush or President Obama should go out and say, well, that Osama bin Laden is or was not a true Muslim. I don't think that an American president has the standing to say that. I think that an American president who said that might cause some Muslims to take a closer look at bin Laden and find his ideas more attractive. So I think we have to be, our approach in the war of ideas has to be, first of all, Hippocratic, not hypocritical, but Hippocratic. That is, first do no harm. Thank you.
Mr. Kyle Gentry, First World War College. I'd like to make one point and try to tease out some more of the so what. The point is I think if you apply the term Islam or Islamism to any adjective, any Muslim is going to take some offense to that. And I can think of several personal examples where any modifier, a true Muslim will take that as a direct attack. Hey, you're describing me. So I think that applying that term will alienate that, that sect that we're trying to, that group of totalitarianists that we're trying to isolate from the rest. I'm not sure, though, that those terms by themselves are enough to isolate and then, isolate the true enemy. Because if you look at Nazism, it wasn't so much hatred to, isolating them wasn't really what defeated the Nazis. It was really more economic power, industrial base, and all that. It wasn't calling communists that defeated communism, it was a collapse of that economic system. So I'm not sure that the mere label of totalitarianism is enough of a distinction to isolate and destroy that enemy. Or perhaps I missed some of the point you're talking about.
Well, with regard to the first point, I am extremely sensitive to it, and the reason that I have adopted the term totalitarian Islamism, with the operative adjective being totalitarian rather than Islamic or Islamist or Muslim, is to try to get away from that. And I would be quite comfortable with American official rhetoric using the term contemporary totalitarianism instead. But in terms of analysis,
we now have to recognize that what we are dealing with is an interpretation of Islam. An abuse, perhaps, or a distortion, but nonetheless, we might make use of the kind of saying perhaps so-called Islamists, this is, I've recommended the use of the term, so-called jihadists or so-called mujahideen, recognizing that that's the way they proclaim themselves without accepting a claim. With regard to is calling them totalitarians enough to isolate and defeat them? Of course not. It's only one particular piece of the use of one instrument of national power. But in both cases, particularly in the case of Marxism and Leninism, the erosion of ideological commitment played a huge role in its defeat. Long before the fall of the Soviet Union, Soviet communism came to mean only the rule of the Communist Party. And there were very few active adherents to Marxism and Leninism. We had, of course, a huge advantage in the Cold War because we could confront Marxism and Leninism directly and say, essentially, don't be a communist, be a capitalist, be like us. And we can't offer the same alternative to Muslims because we would appear to be challenging Islam itself. So the problem of vocabulary is significant, and I see the word totalitarian really as the best solution. The other thing about it is it has so many syllables, it causes a certain amount of detachment. It's hard to use a word with that many syllables as an epithet, so it's conducive to dispassionate analysis.
Brad Moyer, I teach at SAW. Let me say, I like your phraseology, totalitarian Islam, especially radical Islam. The values on the rare occasion when I have need to refer to it, of course, I would say. I'm curious, where would you put the Saudis within your structure?
Okay.
I mean, since the 18th century, the Saudis have been going to the areas in the Arabian Peninsula, saying the population of Islam, your brand of Islam is not very good, we're going to have to do it better. So in other words, Islam isn't a prop for their political power. You might argue that groups like Erdogan, Justice and People's Party, I think it is, in Turkey are sort of doing the same thing. I don't think you call the Saudis totalitarian Islamists, but they do use what you could call a radical form of Islam. They would call it a pure form of Islam because it bolsters their political power.
Well, I agree with the framework that you put forward in that I regard the Saudis as not as totalitarian Islamists. Their ideology, what people call Wahhabi Islam, although no Muslim who with any understanding would ever accept that terminology, is a form of activism, which is not totalitarian, and the Saudi regime presents itself as what I call an extreme Islamist or a Shari authoritarian regime, focusing on the purification of Islam from what they consider non-Muslim influences, and originally the concerns were to deal with Shiism and Sufism and Islamic mysticism. And one of the ways of best understanding the original impetus of the Saudi movement is the first time Saudi armies conquered the city of Medina, they immediately destroyed the tomb of Muhammad because they regarded the Khartoum as a settlement, we think we use it as a site of pilgrimage and perform rituals there similar to those performed at the Kaaba, was causing people to worship Muhammad rather than worship God. I see that the Saudi position, the Saudi ideology is about purifying Islam, but it's about purifying Islam for the sake of making people good Muslims, of obtaining salvation. It doesn't promise utopia. Unfortunately, starting in the 1960s, totalitarian Islamists captured many of the institutions associated with Saudi Islam. When intellectuals associated with the Muslim Brotherhood were facing persecution in Nasser's Egypt, and the Saudis were attempting to set up a university system, many of them went from Egypt to Saudi Arabia, including, among other things, Sheikh Qutb's brother, and one of Sheikh Qutb's brother's students was one of Osama bin Laden. So that the Saudis, essentially, after the seizure of the Grand Mosque in 1981, made what amounts to a devil's bargain with the totalitarians, in which they said, look, you can operate here, we won't give you trouble if you don't cause any trouble at home. And both sides adhered to that bargain until 2002, when the totalitarians started causing trouble within Saudi Arabia, and the Saudis cracked down, arrested a couple of thousand, have executed quite a number of them, and people irreverently say that was when the Saudis got religion. And also has to remember that the Saudi family and the Saudi society is not monolithic, and that there are totalitarians or sympathizers, and certainly among the Saudi family. But the impulse of Saudi Arabia itself is more towards Saudi authoritarianism. Of course, the Sharia makes no provision for monarchy. So the Saudi regime, although they proclaim to be governing in accord with the Sharia, in fact, reflects other political ideas.
Sajid Amin at the back, please.
Afghans are subject to wider combat development than that. On your last point about being a war of ideas, and I don't disagree that calling it totalitarian is a bad adjective, it's very suiting. I think you can align totalitarians who have used Islam to further their agenda just as much as Islamists have used totalitarian means to further their agenda, particularly in the case of the Taliban. Probably a pretty good example, but in the war of ideas, I think in Western society, we don't have, and I can't speak for everybody, we have extremists here just like any place in the world, but I would say the majority of Westerners can distinguish between people who follow the religion of Islam and the totalitarianist types that use that religion to further their own agenda. So I think the bigger challenge in this war on ideas is to get moderate Muslims to understand that it's not a war against Islam, it's a war against totalitarians who are using Islam to further their agenda, whether it's the utopian end and the second coming of the Mahdi, or however you want to put it, in their sales pitch. I think Waleed Fareed, I don't know if you've read much of what he's wrote, but I think he kind of conveys that same message. That the battle of the war ideas is how do we convince the larger Muslim world that doesn't subscribe to totalitarianism that that's not the fight.
I agree with everything that you've said, and that's really the point that I'm trying to make. We cannot win the war of ideas, because the war of ideas, requires developing an authentic, a form of Islamic authenticity that comes to grips with the modern world. And we can't do that. Muslims have to do that themselves. And it's worth mentioning that there is an immense intellectual dynamism, absolutely unprecedented intellectual dynamism within the Islamic world, facilitated in great part by the internet, because the internet permits Muslim women to participate in the dialogue without leaving the house. And that's a very significant change. But as to, and perhaps you're giving the majority of Westerners more credit for a more sophisticated understanding of Islam than I do. But in general, the point is well taken. The key audience here is Muslims in general, because they form the base of recruitment for what I call the totalitarian Islamist network. Now, we are very good at fighting the network itself, using in particular, the military and economic instruments of national power. But we can't win as long as the network continues to be able to regenerate. And the propagation of the idea that the West is at war with Islam is one of the bases of that regeneration. And that's why it's critical to try to refute that perception. So, and just to clarify one point that some people may be unclear on, I am not suggesting that calling the totalitarian Islamists will make them change their views. I am hoping that calling them totalitarians will make it more difficult for them to recruit.
Go ahead, please. Yeah, how do you do, Cal? Yeah, I agree with you, sir. I would rather use the word so-called Muslim than Muslim, because most of Muslims, pious Muslims, as you said, they would be bothered with this label, and they will also be bothered by the etiquette of moderate Muslims as well, because they would say to you, as pious Muslim, I'm more Muslim than this so-called Muslims. But my question here or comment is, since I work on culture, is you mentioned Abu Yusuf as being one of the Jews that worked on the Hanafi school.
The Hanafi, I'm sorry.
And actually the main point of the Hanafi school accepting our previous political systems is due to what we call al-urf, which is culture. It's the school of thought that accepted other cultures as much as what the Maliki and Shafi'i school did, but not that the Hanbali one.
Agree that the Hanbalis, and so far as I know, virtually all contemporary Hanbalis are also followers of Wahhab ibn Abu Wahhab.
Yes.
And with Ibn Taymiyyah in between Ahmad ibn Hanbal and Muhammad ibn Abu Wahhab. They said that the Hanafis were more open to reason, to independent reasoning, and less dependent on tying everything back to the revelation than the other schools. Certainly they were more practical, but the point is that certainly Western scholarship on Hanafi fiqh does not make the point that from its origin, Hanafis accepted the idea of sacred kingship, which is another form of saying the same thing that you did, but much more much more forceful in explaining exactly what the difference is. There's a lot of scholarship on Abu Yusuf and the Kitab al-Arab, such an important text that there are multiple Arabic editions, two different English translations, and one French translation, none of which includes the recognition that this is, in fact, an argument for the authority of the ruler, who happened to be the caliph coming directly from God.
Please, go ahead.
I've got kind of a question, more of a comment, though. I don't exactly like your using the use of the term totalitarian, because I think it's misleading. When I think totalitarian, I think of Nazi Germany, I think of Stalinist Russia, I even think of Hussein's Iraq, because those are what I've traditionally been told are totalitarian states, as in there's a total control over the people. But you're stating that totalitarian Islam, in your definition, is an activist thing, which, if that is the case, then why are you saying we need to figure out a solution to it, or it's our problem, if it's an activist thing? And I understand, yes, Al-Qaeda, you consider them a totalitarian Islamist organization, but if they're an activist thing, that means they're active against some known entity, some state, which means, is it really our problem, or is it those states' problems, and we just need to support them, Al-Qaeda notwithstanding, since they're an international terrorist organization and a transnational organization? But otherwise, why should we say that this is a problem for the United States, and why can't we just say we need to support our partners in the region and let them find a solution for it?
Well, first of all, the reason that I describe it as totalitarian without its being comparable to Nazi Germany or the Soviet Union is that with the minor exception of the Taliban in Afghanistan, they have never had the opportunity to establish a regime. If they did, it would essentially be a government like that of the Soviet Union with the ideology of the Taliban. And the Taliban attempting to suppress things like Kaifline are an indication of the totalitarian nature of the regime. Is the difference between totalitarian and authoritarian is that the authoritarian regimes are primarily concerned solely about staying in power. So behavior that doesn't threaten their staying in power is irrelevant to them. Karl Rittfogel, long ago, developed the concept of politically irrelevant unions to differentiate what he called traditional Oriental despotism from modern totalitarianism. And the reason that the Taliban considered kite-flying a threat is that this was that it was a direction of human consciousness, human thought, in a direction different from their ideology. And there's an old joke that Tom Clancy cites in The Hunt for Red October that the Soviet Union, that seats in public conveyances in the Soviet Union were so uncomfortable because the Soviets were trying to shape the new Soviet man. The change, in that fashion reflects what totalitarian regimes are trying to do. I don't want to give to let the totalitarian Islamists off as totalitarians just because they haven't had the opportunity to put their totalitarianism into practice. With regard to the other question, the United States cannot and should not address this problem alone, but unfortunately, since the totalitarians have engaged us, we have no alternative but to engage them, although to the extent that we can do it indirectly, it's always preferable. But we cannot avoid direct involvement. But when you say we can't confront it directly in the sense that we cannot win the ideological war, that is absolutely correct. But we have to, we can do much better at contributing to the victory of mainstream Islam.
If I may, just on kind of piggyback to your question, your comment brings me to looking at Egypt. the Muslim Brothers War, maybe the history of great history of Egypt, 5,000 years, whatever it is, first time they actually had an election. And they were given a year. They were bad governors, we all understand, but if we go by the 1 year that were given to them, that they were misgoverning, then most governments in the world should be removed. And they were removed, and now they're called terrorists, and their leaders, you know, half of them are about to be executed. It's in that kind of a case, I'm not a supporter of Muslim Brothers, I'm all saying is, when you look at it, the narrative that's written, that here are the people who actually came in through the battles, who tried to be following certain rules, who tried to do certain things even within the international norms, in Gaza case in November, when they were ruled. But what they get kicked out, they get to be called terrorists, and their members are banned. And isn't that, when you, you know, you talk about the totalitarian, and when you're talking about a activism, which I would kind of put it a bit different than what you're describing, wouldn't that also be a recruiting term that geared, had you allowed them to rule, not us, but the Egyptians, and they would have failed, as you say, they would have become another Mubarak, or maybe worse or less worse, then this whole aura of Islam, you know, Islam as a form of governance would have gone out. But when you don't, not you, not you and I, but when they're not allowed by the Egyptians or Saudi money, whoever, to govern, then they, people say maybe they have an answer and nobody is wanting them to come to power. So I'm just asking the question whether the fact that Muslim Brothers are now banned and kicked out from Egypt is not adding to their allure.
Well, that is an interesting question. I remember the first time I heard a similar question was after the cancellation of the elections in Algeria that would have given an Islamist party, also the Islamist party in power. And the question was whether we would have done better to allow them, you know, the Algerian government had allowed them to win, and that they would have shown that we were not opposed to Islam. The problem in both cases is whether that regime would have continued in the manner in which it gained power. In other words, whether or not it would have been one man, one vote, one time. And it appears to me that President Morsi had given some fairly convincing evidence that it would, that his intention was more like one man, one vote, one climate. Another point about this is this anecdote that our friend Dr. Steph Gorka told when he was at FCU a couple of weeks ago, in which he was referred to as someone who had asked a family woman who had voted for the Muslim Brotherhood in the election, and was asked after experiencing their government for a year, whether she would vote for the next time. And she said, well, I'm not going to vote for people who call me an infidel. So I think that the American response to the Muslim Brotherhood electoral victory is an indication that we identify representative government too closely with the process of election. In many cases, elections are the last step in the establishment of a liberal state rather than the first.
Go ahead, please.
Otto Machida with the International Stability Operations Association. I have to confess that I probably fall somewhere between the national security studies and the political conservative studies view of the world. There seems to be, and I've argued this in the previous administration as well, there seems to be this sense that we as Americans, when we hear about the Palestinians being allowed to vote, when we see what is happening in the Arab Spring, we immediately assume and come to the conclusion that some form of Islamic democracy is possible. And I would question, A, whether or not that should be a goal for the United States government, and B, what would an Islamic democracy look like that we could accept?
Well, certainly as a question whether that should be the goal of the U.S. government, there is a tendency, which certainly under the previous administration and this one as well, to assert that the only way to root out what I call totalitarian Islamism is to establish Islamic democracy, which is essentially an idealist means to a realist end, and is. And you know, for one thing, if you're familiar with Mark Sagemann's study of who the totalitarian Islamists are, you realize that they are not, for the most part, the victims of poverty and oppression and injustice. With regard to Islamic democracy, I would raise this, put it this way. The United States, at the time of its founding, was unambiguously a Christian country. And although its institutions established, are purely secular, it could at the same time be called a Christian republic. And certainly, in that sense, the state that the Turkish secularists tried to erect a secular government of a book of Muslim citizens would be an acceptable form of Islamic democracy, if that's what you would call it. Another way of putting it, of describing Islamic democracy, would be a state with an elective government that followed Muslim family and commercial law as the states which were monarchies had constitutions which did not depend on Islamic law, but let Islamic law operate in those spheres. And certainly a regime of that variety, though we would not want to live under it, would not be a threat to the national security interests of the United States. So that's a so that's a part of an answer, but I have to say that Muslims themselves, or in many cases, or the Muslim mainstream in general, has not yet figured out what it considers an acceptable combination of Muslim authenticity and representative government. But many of them are still working on it. But in fact, I think that both this administration and the previous one have overemphasized the efficacy and the possibility of spreading democracy in order to as a means of countering terrorism or preventing terrorism.
We're out of time. You had your hand. One last quick question, and then the rest you can. No, sorry, the lady here. And then the rest you can come in because we are running out of time. Go ahead, please.
Rosalind Stegner, sir, I have an administrative question. Is the Turkey panel on Saturday? Because May 10th.
May 5th. 5th.
Oh, Symposium Idol.
No problem.
Thank you.
Okay. If you don't mind staying for the colonel and the sergeant major, because it's past 1500, so I will thank you. It's been lively. We still have people wanting to ask questions. Thank you very much.